After receiving his law degree from Northwestern University, he spent some years in the private practice of law before turning to a long and distinguished career in public service. From 1947 through 1954, he served as United States District Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. From 1954 to 1961, he donned the judicial role and served as County Judge of Cook County. In 1960, our Speaker was elected Governor of the State of Illinois and served in this position from 1961 until his recent appointment as a judge of the United States Circuit Court. In his role as Chief Executive of the State of Illinois, Governor Kerner has had an outstanding record of accomplishments. He developed a mental health program considered the best in the nation, secured a new criminal code, and reorganized the state court system, enacted the first fair employment legislation in the state's history, and instituted much-heralded revenue reforms, and sponsored the first overseas trade mission on the part of the state government to Europe and the Far East. In the vital field of education, the creation of the Board of Higher Education led to the Master Plan for Higher Education in Illinois, with a junior college system as a key feature. In addition, for the first time in the history of Illinois, expenditures for education not only were at the highest level of any time, but constituted the single greatest item in the total budget. In 1967, Governor Kerner made one of his most outstanding contributions of his long and distinguished career when he served as chairman of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, known throughout the world as the Kerner Commission. The findings of this commission, of which we are all familiar, have served to prod the American conscience toward the solution of its racial problems. These findings become even more important and significant when we consider that the membership of the commission, of which Judge Kerner was the leader, was the most distinguished group. The vice chairman of the commission was Mayor John Lindsay of New York, and other members included United States Senator Fred Harris of Oklahoma, I.W. Abel, President of the United Steelworkers of America, United States Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, Mr. Charles B. Thornton, Chairman of the Board and Chief Executive Officer of Litton Industries, United States Representative James Corman of California, Mr. Roy Wilkins, Executive Secretary of the NAACP, Catherine G. Pedden, Commissioner of Commerce of Kentucky, Mr. Herbert Jenkins, Chief of Police of Atlanta, and Representative William M. McCulloch of Ohio. That our speaker served as the chairman of such a distinguished commission and guided it through many hours of deliberation and hard work gives him an excellent vantage point from which to view the commission's work and other current problems. It is my high honor to introduce our speaker for this evening, one who is a devoted public servant, a true friend of the university, and one whose record of accomplishment is attested to by the fact that he is a recipient of honorary degrees from 9 colleges and universities. Ladies and gentlemen, the governor, the judge, the Honorable Otto Kerner.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor. Young men and young ladies, I'm delighted to be here. As the Chancellor was introducing me, he did mention that I received quite a number of honorary degrees. The surprising and amazing thing to me was that I had no honorary degrees until after I became governor, when they suddenly all realized my intellectual attainment and ability. And, of course, when I received one from my graduate studies, I got the same type of, what do they call them, the drop over your shoulder? Hood that I had earned as a law student at Northwestern. But nevertheless, I'm delighted to be here again. I've sort of been removed from the area of large groups since last May, when I had to make a very deliberate and, may I say, a not very restful type of transition Because moving from an area where I could speak on any subject, being expert on everything as governor, and with no limitations or prohibitions, into a position where I've got to be careful when I open my mouth, because in the judiciary, the federal judiciary, I cannot speak in any political problems whatsoever. And I must be careful even on speaking on items of major interest day to day, so that I almost feel as though I belong in the position with those people who've been declared mentally incompetent, or perhaps have their civil rights removed because of some felonious conviction. And it is pleasing for me to be back here. I've received many invitations, which of course pleases me and wish that I could accept all of them. But in my primary responsibility now of being a judge removed from the everyday way of life, and a very difficult transition, this gives me an opportunity to sort of think back and feel as I did before I left the governor's office. But of course, with all that applause when we came in, I know it was for the chancellor. If I had thought it was for me, I might tell Sam Shapiro to move over and I'd run again. But may I say, I'm particularly delighted that the few times that I can get away from my work in the courthouse in Chicago, although I haven't received many, many invitations to speak to adult groups, because of the limitation of time and space, am speaking this year only to young groups, young adults. Speaking here, I am spending some time at Chatham College, Brown University. Unfortunately, I cannot accept some of the invitations I received from other great universities throughout the United States, but I have turned down all invitations in speaking to strictly adult groups who, on a national basis, invited me to be there. My reason is a very deliberate one, because I have been associated with youth groups all of my life. Number one, I enjoy it. Number two, I have such complete confidence in the young people of today and feel that these social problems, which have sort of apexed and pyramided in the last few years, can be solved largely by you rather than by people of my age and my generation. I feel, as I do with certain adults of my age and perhaps younger, who do not have the technology, know-how, or education to fill those positions of employment that are presently vacant because they are unskilled or so lowly skilled that those jobs are going out of existence. I too feel that, unfortunately, some of the people of my generation have such deep-seated and calcified prejudices that I must depend upon you to help me change them so that you can change them within the home. I'm certain they'd pay no attention to me, because I've received many, many communications over the last number of months, majority of them very pleased to receive. Many of them, I think, if the Postal Department knew what was involved, never would have arrived at my office desk. They're not the type of things, too, that I would like to read publicly. But may I say, I'm more convinced than ever that with the work of the commission, we were absolutely correct, because these are letters of deep criticism that the commission didn't know what it was doing. We did a disservice to the people of the United States. And they are so racist and prejudiced in their opening sentences that they prove the base upon which the report is made. When President Johnson appointed the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders in the troubled and turbulent summer of 1967, there was considerable suspicion on the part of both conservatives and liberals that this was a stalling device, that nothing of moment would come of it. One of our first witnesses, the distinguished scholar and psychologist, Dr. Kenneth B. Clark, said to us very wearily, "I read that report of the 1919 riot in Chicago, and it is as if I were reading the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1935, the report of the investigating committee on the Harlem riot of 1943, the report of the McCone Commission on the Watts riot." And he said, "I must again in candor say to you members of this commission, it is a kind of Alice in Wonderland, with the same moving picture re-shown over and over again, the same analysis, the same reactions, the same inaction." And believe me, he was very cynical. As a matter of fact, in order to have him come and appear before the commission, we had to use the most effective means because of the negative statements we received from him. We worked with some friends of Mrs. Clark's, and she was the one who convinced him to appear before our commission. But he was weary, and he was extremely cynical. Fine a gentleman as he is, and I think added a great deal to the knowledge of those of us on the commission. The event, I'm happy to say, has proved him wrong. The report has aroused nationwide interest, I might even say international interest, stimulated widespread discussion, and engendered strong reactions, sometimes highly derogatory. Why is there such a unanimous feeling among the members of the commission, and more importantly, among the sociologists, students of government, indeed, all those concerned with the problems of urban society, that the report was of value and that it is vital to continue discussion and analysis of the commission's finding and recommendations? One reason is rather paradoxical. It is because, in the words of Tom Wicker, who wrote the introduction of our report, we were an unpromising group. Most of us were not technically expert in the problems of urban society. Our members included no dedicated and flaming radicals, no dedicated and flaming conservatives. We had, with the exception of Mayor John Lindsay of New York, little newsworthiness and less glamour. But the very fact that we, a cross-section of moderate, middle-class, establishment America, could unanimously agree that the single overriding cause of rioting in the cities was none of the things commonly suggested, such as unemployment, lack of education, poverty or exploitation, but rather long-term white racism and the evils derived therefrom in what gives the report real significance. We had the respectable white middle-class Americans with no initial desire to plead culpability. Found after much study and soul-searching that we had no choice but to fashion the initial and continuing blame upon ourselves. And as we stated in our report, a paragraph that has been used over and over again and probably will be continually used, what white Americans have never fully understood, but what the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it. If we, who did not want to see it, and had worn blinders on the subject all of our lives, have finally recognized that white racism as the root cause of civil disorders, then our recommendations must receive America's careful consideration. The second reason why this report has been considered as having unusual significance is that while many of the Commission's recommendations are directed at institutions, both governmental and private, its basic message is to the individual American: eliminate racism. And finally, I suggest that this report is of significance because of my own deep conviction, shared by many others, that we are truly at the crossroads in the development of our country. And if we continue our present policies, they will, in the Commission's opinion, make permanent the division of our country into two societies: one largely Negro and poor, located in the central cities; the other predominantly white and affluent, located in the suburbs and in the outlying areas. We believe that the only possible choice for America is a widespread national commitment of resources to ghetto enrichment, and at the same time a nationwide change in behavior and attitudes which will encourage an integration of substantial number of Negroes into society outside the ghetto. We as a nation have become accustomed to various kinds of prophets' warnings of disaster in particular areas. We read and hear of the accumulating effects of air pollution and of the disappearance of the last remnants of our natural physical inheritance, of burgeoning transportation problems that threaten to choke our major cities. We have lived with these cries of disaster, and not having yet been overwhelmed, have tended to discount them and even ignore them. But I suggest that the racial problem facing us are, in every sense the word, a genuine crisis. Continuation of the status quo will inevitably, and sooner than later, profoundly alter and worsen our lives externally and internally. May I say, we offer the people of America three choices: a status quo which we all confessed would be impossible to maintain; a second choice was separatism, which, of course, is a situation with which neither the black nor the white community could live, and live well; and the last was integration, which I know is offensive to some people, but it is the only true solution to our problem. Because I suggest to you that when I see these mothers and fathers objecting to the busing of Negro children into white neighborhoods, it seems to offend the white person. But this is the trouble: so many people only look at through white eyes. Do you think the Negro children find it pleasant being bused from their community into a white community? And this is what we mean. We must look at it objectively, and not only through our white eyes. It may be unpleasant on both sides for different reasons, but certainly, whether you realize it, whether you wish to admit it, and many of you may not be involved, you think, in this problem. You are already involved, and have been for a number of years. The problem of being born black is one that whites, not blacks, will have to solve. And as I say that, I was thinking of a group of young ladies that came to see me and wished me to participate in a symposium later this year. And I said to the young ladies, well, I'm not going to make any commitment. I want to know what this is about. I want to know who's going to be involved and what subject matter you're going to discuss. Well, they said, of course, it's going to be the race situation. Well, I said, all right, that takes care of subject matter. And now, who have you asked to be involved? Well, we haven't asked these people yet. We thought we'd like to get a commitment from you first. Well, I said, well, who do you intend to ask? They gave me the names of every one of the individuals, and I think I knew them all but one. And I said, now, what problem are you going to discuss? They said, the racial problem. And I said, I presume with the idea of trying to come to some conclusions of being able to help the black community. Said, well, that's what we had in mind. I said, isn't it strange then that you've not asked one black or Negro person to participate? Said, really, basically, what gives you the feeling, unless it's an unconscious feeling of superiority, who know nothing about the conditions as they are in a black ghetto, really nothing about the facts that you're going to solve them? Now, I cite that to you only as an example, unintentional as it is, that the white community for years knows the problem of the Negro, they think, and the problems that exist in a Negro community, in a ghetto. We don't. You know, I heard a statement made by one of the Negro leaders not so long ago on TV, which I thought was most apropos, when someone suggested perhaps we ought to be continuing a study of the Negro problem. And this Negro gentleman said, well, I don't think so. Someone else suggested, well, maybe the Negroes ought to have a study of the white situation. And I thought he very nicely, but yet poignantly, stated, look, the Negro doesn't have to study the white man. He knows about him. He's had to learn to live with him for over 300 years. And really, there's a lot of substance to that. And very difficult for them. But I'd like to point out briefly and touch on some of the highlights and the findings and recommendations of the commission. Our first charge from the president was to find out exactly what did happen. And at this point, I'd like to point out that our direction was from President Johnson that we would look into the civil disorders of the summer of 1967. This then was a calendar limitation period. And this is why the report covers only the civil disorders that occurred in the summer of 1967, all of which occurred in the black ghetto areas of our cities. I know that some of the minority groups felt a bit hurt that they were not covered by this report, but they didn't have any civil disorders. Maybe we should have forewarned them, and they would have been included. But some of their noses are out of joint, and even with many questions that I get, people don't look at our direction. And I think we probably spent the better part of the first day trying to establish guidelines for the commission, because it's such a vast subject that unless we set up very limiting guidelines, we would have done a miserable job, been all over the landscape, and not really delved to the bottom of the particular problem that we were directed to look into. One of the first things we did in organizing was to select field teams. We went out and surveyed riots in 23 cities, and 10 cities were chosen for further intensive investigation. And may I say, these field teams were made up of all kinds and types of people. We didn't select them all white, nor did we select them strictly from the legal branch. We got people who were interested in social work and psychology and the various areas and disciplines so that we would get a pretty good background in depth. But from the resulting studies, we found that there was no typical riot in the summer of 1967. They were irregular and unpredictable. However, some characteristics did emerge. In general, the civil disorders of 1967 involved Negroes acting against local symbols of white society rather than against the white individuals. This is so different from the report that Dr. Clark referred to in the riots of 1919 in Chicago. I was old enough to remember that. This was actually a black, white, white, black confrontation. These disorders have not been a white, black, black, white confrontation. They have basically been an uprising against the white in the Negro ghetto areas. Not against the individual, but the business, the symbol of white in the community. And I think we must make that distinction when we talk about this problem. So it really is not comparable to certain of the race riots that historically we've had in the United States from time to time. The second worst, of course, occurring here in the state of Illinois in 1917 in East St. Louis. In general, as I say, they were acting against the local white symbols. Of the 164 disorders studied, only 5% were considered major in terms of violence and damage, with an additional 20% classified as serious but not major. As a matter of fact, one of the problems last year is that every time there was some little disturbance, a disorderly group, it was fashionable for the media to label it riot or civil disorder. But in a simulation and comparison, really only 5% were major, an additional 25% is serious. So that left really 75% that were labeled civil disorders and riot, but were not, in our opinion. And of the 83 deaths reported, the overwhelming majority were Negro civilians, many of them hiding in their apartments and seeking refuge. Disorders did not erupt out of a single triggering incident, but rather out of an increasingly disturbed social atmosphere that cumulatively, with one incident, lit the fuse. And the potential was in many of our cities last year and still exists in many this year. But at some point in the mounting tension, however, a specific incident would become the breaking point. In almost half the cases, such triggering incidents were proper, lawful police action. What situation, which I think is probably best known, is the arrest of a couple of young men who were speeding. You recall it. The Newark situation, the Newark situation, was the arresting of a cab driver who had violated one of the local ordinances. Perfectly legal, perfect proper. No untoward action on the part of the law enforcement officer. But because of the mounting tensions, even the proper police action was actually the fuse that lit these incidents. The typical rioter was a teenager or young male adult, a lifelong resident of the city, not a new in-migrant, and a high school dropout. He was, however, somewhat better educated than his non-rioting Negro neighbor and was usually underemployed, in other words, not employed to his full capacity, or employed in a menial job. Our teams and we interviewed some 1,200 people in the affected cities, and what the riot appears to be seeking was a fuller participation in the social order and the material benefits enjoyed by the majority of American citizens. Rather than rejecting the American system, they were, on the contrary, anxious to obtain a piece of it for themselves. And this is why those with a little better education, who realized the opportunity was there but did not have an opportunity to participate, were usually those that were in the forefront in trying to obtain that peace that they thought rightfully belonged to them on the basis of their characteristics and ability. And finally, the surveys brought out that during the riots, numerous Negro counter-rioters walked the streets urging rioters to cool it. And I don't really believe many people realize the change last summer from early summer to fall, where many of the young people who might have been participants earlier in the year, reflecting on what had happened to their neighborhood and their community, destroyed their own, later came in the forefront and said, cool it, and helped the law enforcement officers and the administrations to prevent further outbreak. We had an incident in one of the cities where something was bubbling, and this natural-born leader from the community was called in by the chief police and the mayor and said, look, go out and keep it cool. They didn't know whether he would. He did. He did a marvelous job. Not a well-educated man, but a natural-born leader. There's a lot of talent in these communities. And afterwards, of course, the mayor asked him to come and visit and said, you know, I'm a little bit surprised that you did that. He said, you shouldn't be. I can't understand why you're surprised. It's the first time anyone asked me to do anything. This leads to other things that we've suggested in our report of involving these people in the community. They may not have a lot of formal education. They may not be high school graduates or baccalaureates or masters or doctorates. But you know, I've known a lot of people with a lot of wisdom and sense, but not the degrees that we expect today. But this is indicative of involving people, and you will find that they, by their involvement, will work towards a solution of many of these problems. An excellent means of communication, of finding out what the problem is, why, and then seeking suggestions to overcome problems. To determine whether there had been any planning or organization in any of the riots, the commission established a special investigative staff which examined data from local and state law enforcement agencies and collected by the federal agencies, including thousands of documents supplied by the FBI and other federal agencies. And on the basis of this information, the commission concluded that the urban disorders of the summer of 1967 were not caused by, nor were they the consequence of, any organized plan or conspiracy. Now, there are many people that still do not believe this, because, you know, the simple answer to this whole thing to some people would be, there are a bunch of communists who organized this thing and this is what caused it. There is not one iota of evidence or fact for that type of statement. Many people have written me and told me I'm a boob, I'm stupid, I don't know what I'm talking about. Obviously, it was a conspiracy by the communists. I said, well, that's fine. You seem to be completely convinced. Will you send me your evidence? I received a reply from only one, and was from one of those anti-communist groups which do their part, but it was a tract, a printed thing. Not one fact, not one piece of evidence. A bunch of wonderful language, patriotic in nature, and a conclusion. Well, let me tell you, as a lawyer and as a prosecutor, I do not reach conclusions as quickly as certain of my brothers. Because in this type of work, you've got to be careful. As I say, it's a simple way of solving the entire problem. But that is a fact. There is not one iota of evidence. Now, there were instances where people went around and perhaps dried the tinder. Yeah, surely. We never denied that. The fact that the commission found no evidence that all or any of the disorders or the incidents leading to them were planned by some organization does not mean that this cannot occur in the future. We felt, and I recommended then and I recommend now, that investigations continue into a possible organized exploitation of ghetto tensions. In other words, there is a fertile field in many of our communities, both rural and urban, because there were problems in the rural areas as well that did not receive much publicity. That the chemistry is right, and I assure you, all of the law enforcement agencies and the investigative agencies in the United States are alert and are still looking into these matters. The potential is great. Considering now the question of why riots happened, we found, as I indicated in my preliminary remarks, and again I quote from the commission report, white racism is essentially responsible for the explosive mixture that has been accumulating in our cities since the end of World War II. Now, I have to go into a long historical background to explain that, but please accept my word, the facts are in the report. Among the ingredients of this mixture are pervasive discrimination and segregation in employment, education, and housing. These are things that in Detroit, instead of speaking of the big three, having reference to the automotive companies, this is their big three: employment, education, housing. Black in-migration and the white exodus, which have produced the massive and growing concentrations of impoverished Negroes in our major cities, creating a growing crisis of deteriorating facilities and services, and unmet human needs. The third is the black ghettos, where segregation and poverty converge on the young to destroy opportunity and enforce failure. Other factors included frustration of hopes, which sprang up as the result of the landmark Supreme Court decision of 1964. Reaction against white suppression of nonviolent protest, and the growing conviction among young Negroes that there were no legitimate means open to them of achieving redress of grievances. Let me note that all this is happening at a time when nationally economic conditions were getting better and better and not worse. There are few groups in American cities, including Negroes as a whole, who are not, in fact, considerably better off than they were 20 years earlier. But this is something that may be difficult for you to believe. Numerically, there are more Negroes working today, but in 1953, on a percentile basis, more Negroes were working in 1953 than there's working in 1967. Difficult to believe, isn't it? Also, let me point out that with what we thought is greater economic opportunity, the white has increased in his income, and overall, the Negro income of those who are working has gone down. Difficult to believe, isn't it? But this is a fact. So that instead of the gap lessening, what in fact has happened, the gap has widened. And the Negro community is well aware of this, as well as the other poverty areas of the United States. However, the response to this has not been one of rising content, but rather of rising discontent. Skyrocketing white affluence and the observation of this has caused Negro youth to spurn the slower increase in Negro affluence. The commission devoted much study and a significant section of its report to a description of these existing social and economic conditions of Negro life and their historic roots. There is not nearly enough time here today to discuss the social and economic costs of picking black parents. Let me cite, however, one basic one. Comparing medium annual income for whites and blacks in the same educational groups, we found that the advantage to the whites ranged from over $1,000 per year for those with less than eighth grade schooling to $2,200 a year for those with a college education. Equal opportunity? Education pays, but not as well for the Negro. Well, as so many people have said to me, it's true that Negroes have been discriminated against, but other minority groups have suffered from discrimination and yet have been able to escape the ghetto and escape poverty. Why doesn't the Negro do it? And this, again, you know, seems like such a simple comparison. We called upon economists and census experts and anthropologists and sociologists and psychologists to aid us in considering this question, and it was the overwhelming conclusion of the experts in these fields that the reasons for the inability of the Negro to emerge successfully from the ghetto as immigrant groups have done in the past is due to external factors rather than to the commonly cited internal ones, such as lack of desire or incompetence. There are a number of external factors that it is extremely difficult to attempt even an approximation as to their relative importance. But I will hazard a guess that the condition of being black is one of, if not the most important, of these external factors. Because within 1 week of his coming here, assuming neutral clothing and grooming, an immigrant Italian can't be told from a Frenchman, a German from a Scot, a Russian from a Pole, because they're all white. And I thought a magnificent presentation was given by Mr. Hauser, who previously, some years ago, had headed up the Census Bureau, now with the University of Chicago, did at one of the Red Feather luncheons in Chicago, and this is years back, I would guess maybe 10, 12 years, when he went over the in-migration of various ethnic groups into the Chicago area. And it is true. As each of these groups came in, there was a lot of unskilled work to be done. And yes, Mama and Papa and all the kids worked. But the kids got an education. If they made it, they could move to Oak Park or Lake Forest or any other suburban community if they had the bucks to buy their way. The Negro can't do that. But with that generation of immigrants of white complexion, depending upon individual state tastes, cultural and social differences began to disappear. Thus, we can have today in the persons of our vice presidential nominees excellent illustrations of this emergence. And I'll show you what I mean. Senator Muskie looks like everybody's idea of a typical New Englander, doesn't he? Angular, craggy, self-deprecating, clearly descended from early Yankee settlers who have been here for 150 years. In fact, however, he is the son of a Polish immigrant who gravitated to the state of Maine. Governor Agnew, the son of a Greek immigrant, could pose for the portrait of a typical Maryland aristocrat. But color can't be altered, as one can alter a name or table manners. And prejudice against colored people by white Americans has been pervasive throughout our entire history. Another major factor in the inability of the Negro To emerge from poverty has been the changing nature of the American economy. When European immigrants were arriving in large numbers, the majority of available jobs required little or no education. The immigrants holding full-time jobs gained an economic foothold and enabled their children to move up into white-collar and later professional employment. Since the end of World War II, however, unskilled labor is far less essential than previously. And blue-collar jobs of all kinds are decreasing sharply, not just in percentage of the labor force, but in actual numbers. Negroes were pushed out of agriculture by the new farm technology. They found no jobs available to them in the areas where they were then living and working. But then, of course, they found no jobs in the urban centers into which they migrated. They lacked the education and the skills for the new jobs, and the schools and the ghettos were unable to retrain them. I recall a problem that as governor we had to face with the city of Chicago. When the stockyards in Chicago closed down, I would gather that 85 to 90% of the people who worked in the stockyards were Negro. Not a lot of education, but very skilled in the works they were doing. And back in those days, in the early 60s, some of those people were working up, making to $150 and $175 a week. And suddenly, this industry left the Chicago area. Many of them could have had jobs if they had followed the establishment of the new plant. But they couldn't find a place to live where that job was available. So here they had a skill that they could use, but they couldn't work in the area where it could be used. But since they couldn't live there, they had no skill that could be used where they were forced to live. That is when we at the state level went into a very crash program of retraining for new skills. And many who had made very good money because of their slaughtering abilities, we found we couldn't really retrain them because they couldn't go on one of the job training programs because they didn't know how to read and write. So we had to stop really at almost a primary type of educational program to bring up their reading qualities, then put them on the job training. You know, you think everybody knows how to read and write. Don't assume that. We in the white community assume too much that because of our backgrounds, because of our opportunities, that other people are on the same level. They are not. That is why we must learn much about what has been denied a large segment of the population of the United States, and not all black. There are many whites. Numerically, there are more whites in this category than there are blacks. But as I say, nevertheless, despite these and other factors making it extremely difficult for Negroes to escape from poverty, many have done so. There is a strong and a growing Negro middle class. And may I say, those that have achieved that position have had a tough, long, uphill climb. That if you and I were put to the same challenge, might not have reached the same position as they have. We might easily have become discouraged. But because of the color of this growing middle class among the Negro, most of them have been unable to move out of the urban ghetto, even though they had the economic wherewithal to do it. The final responsibility of the commission, as laid down by the president, was to determine what could be done to prevent civil disorders from happening again. We would have liked to have come up with a simple answer and with an easy formula. But in a complex society,
Complex problems can only be met with complex solutions. Today's society is an extremely complicated, technological, communicative, and administrative machine. When malfunctioning occurs in a complicated machine, readjustments have to be made with the greatest of care, because the effects of change that might reflect upon the total operation. So it is with us. Civil disorders do indeed require a cure, but the cure must, at the very least, be better than the disease. And at best, this was our aim, and we must aim for a complete cure. And obviously, we in the Commission did the very best we could in the time that we had available. And we tried to come up with some solutions. We didn't say all. We didn't say that we were the fount of all solutions. We never intended that we should be. With that, then, as our overall goal, these were some of our basic recommendations. The federal government should undertake new and vigorous action to remove artificial barriers to employment and promotion, including not only racial discrimination, but in certain cases, arrest records or a lack of a high school diploma. How many of you realize here that probably 9 out of 10 Negro males, by the time they have reached 20, have been arrested many times? I didn't say convicted, did I? I said arrested. And this is true. Just imagine yourself in the position of a young Negro youth of 19 years of age, going to a factory employment office and filling out an employment form which this young man probably has never seen before, in Anglo-Saxon language, not the language of the ghetto with which he has been raised, which is a different language than yours and mine. And after he fills out his name and address, there is a question: have you ever been arrested? Yes or no? And he marks yes. I don't know, but I would wager that the personnel people in that office, having seen that, would and throw it on the side. Not understanding, not realizing that the young man may have been arrested because he was hanging on a street corner, didn't move along fast enough because the policeman said scat. It could be that easy. Never even determining whether there was any conviction. And this eliminates so many people. And also so many of them do not have a high school diploma, and I think that's really a ridiculous criteria that was required by many companies. Because we know many people were put through school and given a high school diploma and could not efficiently read a fifth grade reading test. So this is a silly type criteria. So these are things that one of the things we've suggested. Secondly, recognizing that if existing disadvantages were not to be perpetuated, the quality of ghetto education must be immediately and drastically improved. The Commission recommended a number of steps designed to accomplish this. You know, long before I was on this commission, I knew from studies of child psychologists that a young person from an economically deprived home, at the time they enter kindergarten, are 2 years behind youngsters coming from a home that has had economic opportunity. Just in the matter of education, in many of these economically deprived homes, and this covers whites and Negroes and Puerto Ricans and Spanish Americans and Indians and all the others in this minority or poverty group, they are not full sentences. Usually is, get me that pail, get that orange, or get this. They're short, concise sentences, and primarily orders. So you take a child that is raised in that home and you put him in with a group of youngsters whose parents may have college educations, who probably can do some reading by themselves when they're in kindergarten, who perhaps have listened to good music, and who, by the way, when they go to bed at night, have peace and quiet, and possibly in a bed of their own, in a room of their own. And you put these two together, what do you expect? There must be these immediate improvements. And it's a very sophisticated program. You know, these youth programs, what do they call them, Head Start, are great. They're wonderful. But those youngsters, during a few months in the summer, have about 4 hours of experience in that program. I'd like to point out something which is obvious to all of us. The day is 24 hours long. And the other 20 hours, they're at home with parents who've had no opportunity, who have seen successive generations of failure, and any motivation started during the day, there's 20 hours to suppress it. So it's much more complicated. There must be programs within the home of the parent as well, so that that progress been made during the day isn't lost before a meeting the next day. There must be sharply increased efforts to eliminate de facto segregation in schools. Extension of quality preschool education to every disadvantaged child in the country. Revision of state aid formulas to assure more per student aid to districts having a high proportion of disadvantaged school-aged children because they need special educational programs to bring them up at least to the level of those youngsters who come from advantaged homes. The Commission recommended a total overhaul of the public welfare system so that it would no longer, as it does now, encourage continued dependency and undermine self-respect. And among the specific recommendations were the establishment of uniform national standards of assistance. This obviously must come about now. In Illinois, I did not feel so badly that we had residency requirements, although I did not favor them. Yet let me say this, in Illinois, we're the only state who proposed this and did it for a while. If the individual found a job where his skills were needed outside the state, we guaranteed to maintain that individual for a year until the individual was able to establish himself in a job and not become a recipient on another state. In other words, we assumed our responsibility. As you know, the Supreme Court is removing, or has removed, all of the residency requirements. We in Illinois over the years have been one of the few states who have met 100% of need. Need I point out what is taking place? There will be a movement from states such as Mississippi, where I think a child is allowed $9.50 per month to maintain that child, where here I think it's somewhere around $38. And other like changes. This is natural, this is human. Therefore, the national, and I told this to President Kennedy as well as President Johnson, that the big cities and the big states were maintaining problems that were not our native problems. We wanted to do it, but they're in migrants. And we did have to sustain them, but actually this was a national problem and not an Illinois problem or a Chicago problem or a New York City, the state of New York and other big cities. And therefore we have to have this sustained by the federal government with certain safeguards. require all states desirous of receiving federal contributions to permit assistance to families with both a father and mother in the home, thus preventing the self-exile of the father in order to allow his family to receive assistance. This gets a bit technical. But if the father is in the home and unemployed, all of the money to sustain that family comes from one of five categories called general assistance, and that is 100% state money. And some states refused to do it. Illinois did. So in the other states, if the father was in the home and not working, no assistance could be given to those children in that family. So our great fathers in Congress forced the father out of the home, and then we condemn the home and condemn the father for leaving. Logical, isn't it? We've done some of the most ridiculous things, and we condemn the people because they were forced to do what we forced them to do. You know, this clears our conscience, doesn't it? Stupid things, but may I say I'm happy in Illinois we overcame a number of these things with state money a number of years ago. Increased incentives for seeking employment and job training in Illinois began this a number of years ago. A family was on public aid, and he went out and earned $10. We didn't take $10 off his next check. We said, we'll take $5 of it. You earn $10, we'll let you keep $7. And it's amazing the way these people began to realize they got something by working. And they became self-sustaining and productive and went off of public aid. We try to do these things, which are beginning now, I think, to filter up to Washington. But since housing problems with their attendant evils are particularly acute in minority ghettos, the commission recommended the federal government enact a comprehensive and enforceable federal open housing law to cover the sale or rental of all housing, including single-family homes. And as you know, Congress did pass an act which will really not become fully effective until 1970, but at least it's a move in the right direction. We also recommended that we reorient the federal housing program to place more low and moderate income housing outside the ghetto areas. And also Congress in recent weeks, just before the recess, the conventions, did pass a housing law that allowed low-interest loans by which an individual if he had so much money for equity, but not quite enough, could, through a federal program, get a low-interest loan to develop a feeling of ownership, pride. Because let me say, the pride of ownership is not exclusively a white characteristic, although many white people believe that. Also, there's a tremendous amount of available housing now in the private sector that many Negroes could afford to live in if they had just a little bit of help. Maybe $5 a month or 10 or 15. And get them in proper type housing so that they could live a proper type of family life, so mother and father and six kids aren't living in one bedroom, where the youngster going to school can have some quiet in the evening to study and not listening to the bawling of an infant child and perhaps the fighting of neighbors next door because of a drunken brawl. These are things that, believe me, are necessary. They don't cost a lot of money. And then, of course, to bring within the reach of low and moderate income families within the next 5 years 6 million new and existing units of decent housing. That doesn't mean building 6 million units, as our critics sometimes point out. There are a great many fine, livable units existent in the United States today but not occupied. The commission unanimously agreed that maintenance of law and order was an essential prerequisite to continued national advancement. Now, we've had many critics, and really this has revealed to me some people who are racist that I didn't think were. Because when the summary of the report was publicized, before the full text was available to really anyone, and one of the candidates on a national level made the comment, "The commission condoned the rioters." I challenge anyone to find where that statement is in the report. As a matter of fact, there's a chapter on law and order, and there's no question what it says. But let me say at the same time, such maintenance for law and order should not be used as a cloak for double standard of justice and protection, one for Negroes and one for whites. The commission therefore recommended that local governments develop neighborhood task forces and develop mechanisms where grievances of neighborhood residents could be objectively considered, review police operations, and provide more police protection in the ghetto, which is what the ghetto wants. Because all the so-called crime that everyone is complaining about is more apt to happen to a Negro in the ghetto than a white in his community. The vast majority of the Negro people overwhelmingly wish and desire more police protection to protect them and their own property, as well as many of the other things that we've suggested. We recommended that the federal government should take immediate action to create 2 million new jobs over the next 3 years, 1 million in the public sector and 1 million in the private sector. May I say I'm very encouraged to see what the private sector is doing as far as it's gone. They're having wonderful experiences in big industry. They're learning, and they're developing a new interest, and with it, may I say, a new attitude. To raise sub-marginal workers to employable standards, to set up more extensive programs that now exist. I've gone over most of these things. We recommended, really, that government organizations, federal, state, and local, should undertake joint effort to consolidate existing manpower programs, to eliminate serious fragmentation, duplication that existed. But in closing, may I say this. While these are highlights of our recommendations, and believe me, I've just skipped the crests of the crests to give you some idea of the substance and background, I could not, of course, mention them all, even in a 2-hour conference or a 5-hour conference. However, were we to carry out all the Commission's recommendations, both the ones that I outlined and the others, we will still not solve the problem unless, at the same time, we take the more important step of altering our individual attitudes and behavior. Every day, either knowingly or unknowingly, white Americans indulge in discriminatory actions against Negroes. We do it in the way we vote, the way we talk, the way we educate children, in the things we buy, and even in such mundane matters as getting our hair cut. White America must make a massive, conscious, and conscientious effort to rid itself, its institutions, of those built-in factors which intentionally or otherwise discriminate against ghetto dwellers. This is not a project for a day or a month and even more. It is not a project for institutions. Basically, it is a project for the individual. It needs to be an integral part of the actions that we, each of us, take. The way each of us thinks. And then with this quote I finish. It is time now to end the destruction and the violence, not only in the streets of the ghetto,
but in the lives of people.
Thank you.